There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
The country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. This week I am with Sarah Basha, and Susan Simpson is going to join us next week. A lot has happened in this past week, most significantly to me, the testimony of FBI Director Comey, and there was then the passage of Trump Care in the House, the new bill, the American Health Care Act. Now, we're going to wait for Susan to get back to get into more of the Russia investigation. You know, she takes the lead on that stuff. But instead, this week we are going to dive into this other single issue, the one that's been really dominating the headlines for the past few days, and something that I think is going to have a really profound impact on all our lives. We also have a special guest on today who's going to help us unpack Trump Care and understand its implications for us. But we want to touch on something very briefly first before we get to our interview, before we get to the healthcare bill. And that's an issue that a lot of feedback came back for us, and some of it was very agitated. And Sarah, that was mostly directed towards you, and that's Planned Parenthood. So I'm going to turn it over to Sarah because she really wants to address this before we get into the bigger discussion.
Sure. Thanks, Rabia. Well, you know, that segment that we had on abortion went off on a tangent in many ways. I was trying to bring up the Title X or Title X funds, and I think we got confused between that and the Hyde Amendment, and then people started jumping all over the statement that some of us don't want our taxpayer dollars going to abortion. And actually, I don't mind people having differing opinions and kind of even getting a little mean, but what does bother me is their understanding of where their taxpayer dollars are going and how that's related to abortion. So I just wanted to mention real quick a great resource and also make a couple of points about taxpayer dollars and the funding of abortion. So really quickly, what are Title X funds made up of? Well, they're a combination of four things. They're congressional appropriations, additional federal sources of money, Medicaid reimbursements, and state and local funds. So the overwhelming majority of Planned Parenthood funds come from Medicaid reimbursement, which a lot of people had messaged, and we know is a fact. And some comes from the Title X allocations, but not all of it, because most is covered by states. So I'm going to try to make this like really layman in some ways. But when you get your paycheck, you have to pay your taxes, right? So where do your taxes go? Well, your taxes goes into payroll, which consists of Medicare and Social Security. Then it goes into 12 other categories like education, energy, agriculture, and interest on the national debt. And then 70% is spread between national defense, job and family security insurances, food and housing assistance, and drumroll, Medicaid. So there is indirectly taxpayer subsidizing of abortions through the Medicaid reimbursement. There is a person by the name of Chris Conover. He's a research scholar at Duke and contributor at Forbes magazine. He does a section called The Apothecary, and he verifies that taxpayer dollars do subsidize abortion. And he's written a piece. It's dated October 2nd, 2015, and it's called Are American Taxpayers Paying for Abortions? And I want to read just a little snippet of that so that people can understand where taxpayer dollars and abortions are connected. And here it is. Quote, as best I can determine, taxpayers subsidize roughly 24% of all abortion costs in the U.S., with 6.6% borne by federal taxpayers and the remaining 17.4% picked up by state taxpayers. If we apply the 24% figure to the total number of abortions, this is equivalent to taxpayers paying the full cost of 250,000 abortions a year, with about 70,000 financed by federal taxpayers and 180,000 financed by state taxpayers. So essentially, what the Senate bill that Mike Pence tipped over did was really put the bulk of Title X at stake for being tied to abortions outside of the Hyde Amendment or the H.R. 7 parameters. And it put the onus on the states. But the states, I mean, Planned Parenthood won't necessarily be the only provider. And some people argue that abortions may even go up if other facilities are motivated to get those funds. So
here's my response, because we've been encouraged to have robust debate. I'm not going to make it real robust. Susan's not here, and I feel like we are going in a circle on this. But here's the thing. So you mentioned the Hyde Amendment, but then you said that's a different issue. But let me explain what the Hyde Amendment is to folks and how that plays here. Since 1976, the Hyde Amendment has blocked federal Medicaid funding. But here's the thing. There are very narrow exceptions in when those Medicaid funds can be used for abortion. Narrow, narrow exceptions. Number one, when continuing the pregnancy will endanger the woman's life. So not her health, but literally her life, okay? Or when the pregnancy results from rape or incest. So when he says of all the abortion costs, 6.6% are borne by federal taxpayer dollars, which is, you know, the issue that you said that you objected to, even that amount going towards it. That's not 6.6% of our taxes. That's 6.6% of all abortion costs. Those must be, if they are coming from Medicaid, they can only be, if they can only exist if they fall within those two very narrow exceptions, and that's it. So, but here's the thing now. So this issue at this point, because I don't know if folks know, but you know what? The Planned Parenthood is getting funded again this year. It did not get defunded. That was considered kind of like a loss for the administration, but they kind of didn't care because they got their defense spending and Homeland Security budgets, you know, way up high. And so they were happy with that. They agreed to keep the funding for Planned Parenthood. So it's not exactly, I don't want to say it's a moot point, but
no, because you know look, the bulk of what they do is needed. It's healthcare access for women, right? But the point is, the way some of the media has put it, I mean, you have to understand that most of the abortions are taken care of by state anyway. So it doesn't change.
Right, 24% of abortion costs, like you said, right? It does. Right, that's true. So, but then I guess my question to you, Sarah, is like, if it's not such a huge cost to begin with, why even the discussion of defund on a federal level? I mean,
well, and you know what? This is what I wanted to say. I think it's a very political move. It was a move to reverse something that Obama did in December 2016, right before he went out. It's a kind of in-your-face statement to the Affordable Care Act of, we are going to stop this funding. And it's an attempt to sort of address that whole in healthcare access in a fundamentally different ideological way. Okay. And I think it was that kind of a move. And obviously with this new, you know, the new paradigm that you just stated where Planned Parenthood wasn't defunded eventually, I think people understood that it was, again, part of that rhetoric. But, you know, does it put more control into the hands of the states? Yes, it does, but states already had a lot of that. Can it be abused by some states? Like lots of people wrote that in. Yes, it can. But the onus is now on people to sort of get more active and civically engaged in pushing state and local lawmakers to make the changes they need to keep women's health care up there as a priority and keep it, yeah. You know.
Yeah, and I think it's important for our listeners to understand that I don't think it's that Sarah ever felt necessary. Although I know you do have your reservations because of, you know, your own personal beliefs about abortion and where our taxpayer dollars should be spent. But I don't think that means at all that you want to take away women's healthcare access. I mean, the real concern was this, that if federal dollars only pay for 6.6% of abortions, removing all federal funding from all kinds of programs, if a facility, you know, offers these in these two narrow exceptions, right? Or offers abortions at all. That was a big concern. But we can all breathe a sigh of relief that it's not going to happen. So, we are now going to move on and get into a little bit about the new healthcare bill, which has passed in the House but has not hit the Senate yet. We don't know when the Senate bill is going to be. Before we get to our guest, who is just fantastically qualified and is really going to help us understand all these things, let's talk a little bit about the differences. So our listeners have, you know, a good foundation to understand what the major differences are between this and Obamacare.
Make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. And I think most importantly, yes, premiums will be coming down. Yes, deductibles
will be coming down. But very importantly, it's a great plan. And ultimately, that's what it's all about. We knew that wasn't going to work. I predicted it a long time ago. I said it's failing. And now it's obvious that it's failing. It's dead. It's essentially dead.
So let me start off by saying this. According to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, it's important to note that they have not done a full analysis of this bill. They did one on the previous bill. It's a very preliminary analysis. And that's one concern that folks have, is that the House did not give the CBO a chance to do a full analysis of what the impact of this bill would be. But according to a preliminary analysis, up to 24 million people will lose insurance by 2026. And there's a number of reasons that you would lose your insurance. And one of them is if you don't maintain your insurance, then getting back on it would be very expensive. Let's talk a little bit about the difference in the tax credit structure, Sarah.
Yeah, so with the tax credit, you have an age-based credit so that a person there's going to be $2,000 a year for a person in their 20s and about $4,000 a year for people over 60, so that some people's insurances will go up and some will go down depending on their age and where they live. So that's like a new feature of this proposed bill in the House.
I mean, it's a feature, but that's only because, you know, tax credits are being taken away. The, you know, Obamacare had refundable tax credits, which 80% of the people who enrolled in Obamacare after it was passed actually qualified for those tax credits. This eliminates those tax credits completely. Okay. So in place of that, they have these new age-related tax credits, I think, to kind of offset that. But it's the numbers aren't working out. It won't completely offset it. There's going to be a big, big gap there. Another thing that's another difference is that the mandate, the individual mandate, has been eliminated. So no more tax penalty. It was under Obamacare if you did not get insured. Right. And that was a big issue for a lot of people. And I, you know, even as somebody who is, you know, I identify as a Democrat, that was kind of a burden on folks. It was hard for some people who they're like, you know, we can't afford insurance and now we have to pay a tax because we can't afford insurance. But that's been eliminated.
Yeah, but listen, I mean, I, as a conservative, found that really troublesome because there was a period in my life when I sort of had to shop around and I was like, well, Obamacare doesn't really work for me because it's just about as expensive as anything else. And if anything, it's going up. And the problem was that if I didn't get something really fast, I was going to be hit by taxes. So yeah, that irked me quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that was hard. That was, I understood the philosophy behind it, but I thought that was for people who are already struggling financially. And, you know, I would have been fine if an overhaul of Obamacare didn't include so many other provisions but got rid of the individual mandate, I would have been fine. Because there must be another way to incentivize folks, like the tax credit instead of a tax penalty, right, to enroll. But here's the thing, though. The new bill also eliminates a different mandate, which does concern me and I don't like. And that is the Obamacare mandated that any employer that had at least 50 employees provide access to affordable insurance through the employer. And now that under this bill, that's been eliminated. So if you have an employer that has 100, whatever, I mean, however many employees, they have no obligation to provide access to health insurance. That's a concern to me.
Yeah, that goes back into that whole idea of giving the states more power over how things are run. And of course, there is that danger of the state tending to allow employers to choose low premium worker plans that, you know, have limits on lifetime and annual benefits. So that's always going to be an issue now with this bill. But of course, you know, CBO doesn't have a breakdown of this yet.
Yeah, it doesn't. They still have to do a full analysis, and I hope they do it before it hits the Senate and it's not just pushed through. You talked about the state issues, and it seems like this bill heavily favors states because states, and this is a big concern again for me, because the kind of waivers the states can get to Obamacare are these things. Number one, states can apply for a waiver that would allow any insurers in the state to basically get rid of essential health benefits. And those are things like, and that's the thing, essential health benefits is a term of art. Those are things like maternity services, mental health and substance abuse, prescription drugs, rehab, outpatient care, emergency, lab work, a pediatric service. These are considered essential health benefits that are mandated under Obamacare. This bill would allow states, number one, to get a waiver for those. It would also allow states to get a waiver to deny pre-existing condition coverage. And we're going to talk about what that means.
Yeah.
It would allow insurers to charge elderly people more than 5 times what younger people are charged. I mean, and it would allow annual lifetime benefit limits for employer plans, which don't exist right now. Obamacare got rid of those. So all of these things would now go to the state. And, you know, you can imagine in the states that get these waivers, the kinds of plans that insurers will definitely have more plans to offer. And in states where maybe they don't apply for the waivers, I think, you know, premiums are going to be very, very high for people. They're just going to find another way to, you know, I think the insurance companies have a lot of culpability here.
Yeah, but here, I mean, and that's what the vague part is that the CBO has to clarify is states will by law required to find another way to ensure expensive illnesses or high-risk pools are covered, and they'll be getting like a pool, you know, $138 billion over the 10-year span, but we don't know how that's going to play out. We don't know how that law will be enforced, and we don't know what kinds of things they will do to make up for that.
We don't know. And because we don't know, it's kind of a crapshoot as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you mentioned high-risk pools. I do want to discuss that with our guest because I think that's going to hit mostly people who are, many people who are covered in Medicaid. And Medicaid is a federal program that assists people who are in poverty or disabled with their medical insurance. There are 70 million Americans, 70 million who are enrolled in Medicaid. This bill cuts $900 billion, dollars in funding, and it'll cut 14 million people from the program who are supposed to, theoretically, be assisted by the states in these things called high-risk pools. Another thing that I forgot to mention was that states could require, and this is also for Medicaid people, that if you're able-bodied, so if you're poor but you're not disabled, that you have to work, do community service, or get job training in order to get those benefits.
Yeah. There's a lot of issues with this, and I think, you know, the thing is that there are many senators on the Republican side that have issues with this. Four of them have been very vocal about it. But these are senators who actually have Medicaid expansion in their states. And so I'm thinking there's going to be huge roadblocks. And if you look back at the last attempt in the House, there were so many House members that didn't like the original plan. And that included one of the congresswomen that I work with, Barbara Comstock. And she, you know, I have to say, we walked into her office with someone that I had met, this really nice young lady with multiple sclerosis, and we went into her office. She sat with her for a long time, looked at her case, and even though she didn't really belong in her district, she was open to listening to the issues with the bill. And I think people need to recognize that there are a lot of Republicans at the district level that have issues with this, and now there's going to be a lot of senators that are going to be digging into this to see what the problem is.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll see how that goes forward. And we're going to talk about Medicaid expansion to explain that to folks a little later, too. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably like me and my co-host, always searching to learn more. That's why we are big fans of the Great Courses Plus video learning service. These are great video lectures on so many topics presented by award-winning experts. So you can learn more about politics, world history, science, how to take better pictures, and a series that I'm following right now, How to Be a Better Cook. I really want you to try the Great Courses Plus, so they're giving my listeners a special chance to stream hundreds of their courses for free. I mentioned one of my favorites, which I'm watching right now, The Everyday Gourmet, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking. So a confession about me in the kitchen. I am not a bad cook, but I do not make desserts. Maybe once or twice a year I will attempt it, but I'm just not that confident with making desserts. So I'm really excited because this week I watched the video lecture titled A Few Great Desserts for Grown-Ups, which is perfect because I do entertain a lot and there are a lot of grown-ups. So I look forward to trying out the tips I learned in this video. I love the Great Courses Plus. I watch it. I often have it on in the background while the baby is sleeping. As many of you know, I have an infant. He is not quite 3 months old, so this lecture series keeps me engaged. I keep learning while I take care of him at the same time. I love the Great Courses Plus, and I want you to try it too. As one of my listeners, sign up for the Great Courses Plus with my special URL, and you'll immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all their lectures. That's one entire free month of unlimited access to all their lectures. So sign up today at thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Again, remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. So now we're going to get into a deeper discussion with a fantastic guest who I think the timing couldn't be better to talk about this. And Sarah, I'll turn it over to you to introduce him.
So this segment is on the American Healthcare Act, and the guest we have on today is someone I really admire as I've gotten to know him. He's very knowledgeable, and he's a stellar individual who I think will be someone to look out for in the future as a leader. And he certainly is of a caliber not easily found today. So Sharif El-Nahal is a physician and adjunct professor of healthcare management at Georgetown University and serves as the chief quality and safety officer of the Veterans Affairs Health System. Welcome to the show, Sharif.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start off, Sharif, by asking you a little bit about, and I think, you know, this kind of sets the stage for really why these conversations are happening here versus other countries. And I know, I mean, we have listeners that are international and even online. You get so many like confused, so much confusion internationally about what is happening in America. Why, what is up with the American attitude towards healthcare? And that is whether or not healthcare is considered a right or a privilege in this country. So can you talk a little bit about that with your background and the work you've done? What is the American attitude towards healthcare, and why is it so different than, let's say, that in Europe or even our neighbor to the north?
I think that's a really good question. And in fact, it really underlies the entire debate around what we're trying to achieve with federal legislation, state and local legislation around healthcare. The debate really centers on what you're trying to achieve. The narrative that President Obama had, as well as the House and Senate Democrats that ended up voting for the Affordable Care Act, was prioritizing coverage, that the American values essentially spoke to the notion that healthcare is a right and not a privilege. And therefore, the legislation was written to maximize coverage for American citizens while distributing those costs among the entire country. So by definition, you would expect, and really this is how insurance markets work in general, but you would expect with the various provisions of the Affordable Care Act that most people would have to pay a little bit more to cover those in need of low income and of high disease morbidity. So that sort of underlied the rationale and the movement behind the Affordable Care Act. The narrative on the other side of the spectrum politically is around costs and sustainability and flexibility. So what does that mean? Costs both to the consumer and to the larger healthcare system overall, and the concept that people should have the appropriate choices for their own healthcare, because that's what we are as a nation, one that offers flexibility and choice to its citizens, which means that in terms of the value, the values underlying the American Healthcare Act, that people could ostensibly choose to be covered with a bill that does not necessarily cover a set of minimum health benefits, and in particular does not cover the costs of as much of the country's sick people. And so really that's what underlies the debate. It also has to do with constituencies. So what do I mean by that? The poorer, older, sicker Americans in this country would much prefer to have the Affordable Care Act in place, especially the millions of people who are covered as a result of the legislation, both under Medicaid expansion and under the subsidies and insurance marketplaces that the Affordable Care Act
offers. This is all under Obamacare, right? Under
all under Obamacare,
to be clear.
Yeah. Yep. Yes. On the other hand, you have important constituencies like small businesses who had to cover the costs of health insurance if they had over 50 employees. And many associations of small businesses throughout the country therefore opposed the Affordable Care Act because they said, in turn, we won't be able to hire as many people because of the per employee costs. So there are tangible incentives to fall on one side of the spectrum or the other, not just politically motivated, but very practically motivated by the goals and incentives in place for people. So I think you really have to step back and ask yourself the question of what you're trying to achieve and what values you have that underlie your decision-making position on this issue.
I mean, that's a great summary, Sharif. And I wanted to ask you, just as your position at the Veterans Administration, how your experience in both the field of medicine and the health administration side allows you to have this unique perspective on the two systems in recent days.
I think that's a great question. One thing to mention about the VA is that we are a federally capitated government health system. So we're not necessarily subject to the same market pressures as the private sector. That being said, we do have a lens into what private sector health institutions, hospitals, insurance plans are thinking because we work with them every single day. I will tell you that across the spectrum of the healthcare system, there is substantial opposition to the newest version of the American Healthcare Act that was passed by House Republicans. The American Medical Association, which represents individual physicians and many physician groups and constituencies, essentially came out condemning the legislation, with the president issuing a strongly worded statement that it does not achieve the objectives of a responsible healthcare system. That is because the vast majority of membership, again, who are individual doctors who see patients, would see a lot of their patients lose coverage. And as someone who has seen patients before, in particular patients with cancer, that is a pre-existing condition that used to be grounds for denying insurance. And often you would have patients coming in with diagnosed cancer who would not be able to get longitudinal care, even for curable cancer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from the physician perspective of a physician, this is a big deal, which is why the American Medical Association has taken the position that it has out of the auspices that a lot of people would lose coverage with this bill. But even larger institutions like health systems, hospitals, CEOs of those, in particular those that have business models around treating the poor and the underserved, who are often on Medicaid and have benefited from Medicaid expansion, have also come out against this bill. So now we're talking about both hospitals as a whole and physicians. And then finally, America's health insurance plans, in a rare sense of unanimous opposition, have also joined the chorus of organizations that are against the plan. The director of this trade group, Marilyn Tavner, which again represents most health insurance plans in America, has also come out against it. So everybody has a stake in this, but this is a rare situation where the American healthcare system, in terms of the constituents that are serving patients across the spectrum, seem to be against the bill.
So Sharif, you mentioned a couple of, like, really important points that are going to be impacted by if this bill passes the Senate or any version of this, if they keep in some of these provisions. And two of them that I want to get into a little bit deeper and to explain to our listeners, like, what the issue really is here and what these things mean are pre-existing conditions. And then the second would be Medicaid expansion, what that was and what this bill does to it. So can we talk a little bit about pre-existing conditions? Like, what is a pre-existing condition, number one? And who decides what a pre-existing condition is and who has always decided? And now who has the power to decide whether or not these people get covered if you have a pre-existing condition?
So pretty simply, and unfortunately this is a broad definition, but it is essentially any medical condition that you might have before you apply for insurance coverage. And so you had a situation before the Affordable Care Act where insurance plans would essentially have at least two what we call risk pools in their plans, one for younger people who are not as sick, and other layers and stratifications of plans offered to people who are more sick. And so what you ended up seeing are that where the healthy people would pay reasonable or low premiums, and sicker people would either have to pay very high premiums or even not qualify for insurance at all. Now, a pre-existing condition is defined by the insurance plan, traditionally. They would be able to say what qualifies for a pre-existing condition versus not in terms of the plans that they offered. This situation was very frustrating for a lot of people because often they would be covered, or often they would be applying for an insurance plan, and then after discovery of a condition that either wasn't disclosed when they originally applied or has been discovered during the application process, they would be denied coverage. And of course, those people that have pre-existing conditions are more sick and actually need the coverage. So that is essentially the definition of a pre-existing condition.
So Sharif, how does this affect, in terms of the definition, the disability community, which consists of, you know, kids with, especially kids with mental health issues? I mean, do they fall into that category too?
They would. And children are covered through various other mechanisms. There is a children's health insurance plan that would remain in place nationally, even if this bill were passed. But in general, it's probably helpful to go through what this version of the American Health Care Act says about people with pre-existing conditions versus the one that was originally rejected by the Republican caucus in the House. The negotiating strategy for House Republican leadership in the White House could have gone two different ways. They either could have courted what we now call the Tuesday Republicans, quote unquote. These are moderate Republicans in the House who much preferred that the original bill be more generous and certainly maintain universal coverage for pre-existing conditions. In other words, taking away the right for insurance plan to charge individuals more money based on their disease profile. Or they could have gone the way of trying to court the more conservative Republican caucuses, including the Freedom Caucus. They clearly chose to negotiate more with the Freedom Caucus because that was the essentially the constituency that ended up not putting up the votes for the original bill. An amendment that was introduced to essentially get them on board is called the MacArthur-Meadows Amendment. This was proposed by both a moderate Republican and a Freedom Caucus Republican that allowed states to apply for waivers to the rule that you're not allowed to deny people based on pre-existing conditions. So states could apply for that waiver, but in return, states would have to present a plan and implement what we call high-risk pools. This is a state-level fund that would cover individuals who lost their insurance as a result of a state-level waiver if you ended up going 63 days without insurance. So one of the main effects of the original bill, which remains in this one, is that the subsidies for individuals was now based on age as opposed to ability to pay or income. That naturally underscored a lot of the assumptions that went into the number that 24 million people would lose their insurance if this bill was passed.
That not being able to maintain that insurance and having the 63-day gap. Right.
Because they would be faced with higher premiums, and there's a recent study out of Boston that showed that people are very, very price responsive to premiums, even sick people, and would rather let go of their insurance and then go to the emergency room than keep their insurance. So in other words, the number of people would be significantly high who could have a 63-day lapse. If they had that lapse and they tried to reapply for health insurance, then they could be, the premiums would be a lot more expensive because they would have a pre-existing condition and the state would have a waiver in terms of charging them.
And they could also be completely rejected, right? They could be outright rejected. They could say, because you have you've had the gap and you have a pre-existing condition, you don't even qualify. Like if the state gets a waiver, if they happen to live in the state, they could also just not be eligible for any insurance, right?
Well, what high-risk pools would be designed to do is to not say no, but offer a alternative plan for patients who are sick. And so,
don't they have that $138 billion over a 10-year span for the high-risk pool?
Yeah, so let me break that down. The legislation calls for states, the original legislation called for states to get $100 billion over 10 years to stabilize the individuals who would lose insurance because premiums would be too high and the subsidies would be insufficient. Because again, subsidies for people who are older and poorer would go down while their healthcare costs would remain high. And so you would expect those people to lose their insurance. So the stopgap that Republicans offered is the following: $100 billion to stabilize those individuals and allow states to help them cover their insurance. In particular, $15 billion in addition to that to cover services like drug addiction services, mental health programs, and other specific programs that would be targeted to vulnerable populations. And then an additional $15 billion for what we call high-risk pools. Again, this is a fund that would be set aside to cover sicker individuals who would not be able to afford the normal plans. The corrective amendment by a Michigan representative named Frank Upton, Republican, that ended up getting enough moderate Republicans to push this bill through, calls for an additional $8 billion to go into this concept of high-risk pools over the next several years. It may be helpful to break down what the history of high-risk pools have been and what their utility has been, because the argument that Republicans are putting forward is that these high-risk pools would essentially cover folks who have pre-existing conditions but would lose coverage under the Obamacare insurance. So high-risk pools have been implemented historically in about 35 states. Just so that you're calibrating, up to 27% of all adults under the age of 65 have health conditions that could reasonably be called pre-existing conditions. So these are the folks that, that is the total pool of people who could conceivably be covered by high-risk pools. But the total number at any point in history of people covered by high-risk pools throughout the country was just over 220,000 people. So we're talking about 27% of America who could have been covered by high-risk pools, and only 220,000 people who were actually covered by them. Why is that? That's a pretty big gap. Number one, the premiums offered by high-risk pools historically have been much higher than what we call standard non-group rates. So if you don't have a job that covers your insurance or offers insurance, you would have to go into the individual market, or what's called the non-group insurance market. So most states that had offered high-risk pools before the Affordable Care Act, before there was a requirement to cover people with pre-existing conditions, charged up to 150 to 200% of those market rates. So anywhere between 1.5 and double the rates. Now, some states, and these are the states that Republicans happen to tout for having working high-risk pools, like Oregon, did offer discounts if you were at or near the poverty line, up to 183% of the poverty line in Oregon's case. But that being said, historically, premiums are much higher for these folks in high-risk pools. The second thing is that nearly all of them excluded pre-existing conditions coverage for at least 6 to 12 months. So let's say you were an individual who was diagnosed with cancer, and this is unfortunate because it used to happen all the time before the ACA, and your insurance company finds this out, digs into your medical history, and figures out that you actually had a condition that wasn't disclosed to them, and therefore denies coverage for that cancer. Those people would lose their insurance. Those people would not be able to maintain their insurance because they wouldn't be covered for their most important problem. Now, for 6 to 12 months, depending on the state, they would not be covered even by high-risk pools for their cancer, which can be catastrophic for people with a diagnosis like that. So that's another thing to understand, because they had to, of course, control costs. The third thing is that most of them had lifetime limits. So $1 to $2 million lifetime limit for people in high-risk pools. If you have a diagnosis of a complex disease or cancer, your lifetime healthcare costs could well exceed $1 million because of the high healthcare costs we have in the system. And then finally, 29 states out of the 35 had at least a $1,000 deductible. In 10 states, it was over $5,000.
Wow.
So that's why, even though people had this option of joining a high-risk pool, it wasn't practical for them anyway. Now, what we're talking about in terms of what's offered by this bill is a total of about $23 billion, if you include the original $15 billion offered in the bill that was put up in March, for these high-risk pools. Now, if you're talking about 24 million people losing their insurance, a substantial percentage of them, and by the way, these are people who tend to have high risk, they tend to have pre-existing conditions much more than the general population, so you're probably talking about more than 27% of this pool of people who would lose their insurance. You're talking about a system that cost about $7 billion just to cover people, about 225,000 people, up to about 500,000 people in these high-risk pools. That is not going to be enough. The numbers turn out to be $2.3 billion a year, if you include everything, offered to the additional people who would lose insurance. That is not going to cover the vast majority of people who would end up losing insurance and who have pre-existing conditions. Again, in the states that apply for these waivers and are granted.
Listeners, I am very excited to talk about this next sponsor because I'm telling you, it has changed my life. I am a notoriously bad sleeper. I sleep very light. For years, I have had backaches, and I'm not kidding you. My life has been changed since I got a Casper mattress. I have never slept so well. My back pain is gone. I'm not kidding. I promise you, this is the absolute God's honest truth. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines support memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. When my husband moves around, I can't even feel it. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. There is free shipping and returns all across the United States and Canada, and you can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, and I promise you, you will, they will pick it up and refund you everything. It is designed, developed, and assembled in the U.S. No more spending thousands of dollars on mattresses that don't give you a good night's sleep. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers, which eliminates the commission-driven inflated prices. And the award-winning sleep service was developed in-house. It's got a sleek design. It's delivered in a small little, how in the heck do they do that, box. And in addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. Now, you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/45. Again, that's www.casper.com/45 and using the code 45. I promise you will not regret it. You'll be like me. Once you go Casper, you will not go back. I think that, you know, you said that, you know, initially there was $15 billion of funding for this to assist in this, and then they added more to, I think, to sweeten the pot and to coax more GOP leadership towards a bill. But, you know, they, knowing that it still falls way, way short, like way short, and many, many people, are, especially the sickest, are going to be like losing coverage. I keep going back to kind of like the idea of values. There was an article in the Washington Post that said, this is the quote, "The theory is that removing sicker people from the markets and allowing policies with skimpier options would result in overall premiums for, I guess, you know, the majority of Americans." And so that is the trade-off that we are facing as Americans. There's a map that's offered by the Kaiser Family Foundation on the website. You can go to the map, you can say, okay, this is my age and this is my income level and this is where I live. And how is this going to impact my premium? My premium is actually going to go down. My deductible is going to go down. But that is at the cost of removing the sicker people from markets. When you say from markets, I'm like, that's from life. We are removing them from living is what that really means. And I have a lot of trouble with this. I don't understand how we are okay with this, allowing this to happen.
Well, Rabia, you mentioned the Kaiser Family Foundation. They also cited that 36% of Medicaid goes to those who also have Medicare. So this is also about aging people. So,
and actually, can you discuss that, maybe the difference between Medicaid and Medicare?
Medicare covers anybody over the age of 65 per legislation that was passed under Lyndon Johnson. And so it is the by far the biggest payer in the country. This is something that is an entitlement when you reach the age of 65. Medicaid is typically administered by states. In fact, it's administered by states universally, but is a fund for people of low income to have them covered by a particular type of insurance. What you refer to, Sarah, are the quote-unquote dual eligible population. These are individuals who are older, sicker, and tend to be disabled. And these are the constituencies that tend to be covered by both Medicare and Medicaid.
So can we talk a little bit about Medicaid expansion and what that was and how that's going to be impacted by if this bill passes the Senate?
Medicaid expansion is something that 31 states took advantage of under the Affordable Care Act. This allowed people to be covered up to 138% of the poverty line. So this, again, is the insurance that covers low-income citizens. Studies showed that it worked quite well in states that passed it. It had to be typically passed by the state-level legislative bodies and signed by the governors to accept Medicaid expansion. Studies showed that it increased primary care access, increased quality of life, and actually an association with reduced mortality for people who, for states that had expanded Medicaid. So you're talking about lives saved through health insurance coverage. There are studies that showed that. The topic of Medicaid expansion is very interesting because this was something that used to be opposed almost universally by Republicans, but in states where it was passed and actually worked, that we typically view as red states because of their political ideology, many senators who have seen the benefits of Medicaid expansion are now questioning this bill because of what it does to the prospect of getting it if you don't have Medicaid expansion and the funds offered to you if you already do have Medicaid expansion. So what this bill does is that it decreases funding after 2020 for states that already have it, and essentially caps you at 2016 rates. So basically does not offer you more money over time based on the number of people who are on Medicaid. It also, in terms of this newer compromise bill, prevents additional states from expanding Medicaid to cover poor childless adults. So Medicaid expansion would not be able to do that in the future if you applied for it as a state. So again, there are a number of states that were trying to and looking forward to passing Medicaid expansion that would not be able to for a substantial population. There are at least four Republican senators now who've openly opposed the American Health Care Act as it's currently written. All of them are in states that have expanded Medicaid.
Yep.
Rob Portman of Ohio, Shelley Morcapito of West Virginia, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Cory Gardner of Colorado. These are Republicans and people who really have seen the benefits of Medicaid expansion and want to make sure that any reform to healthcare that is passed essentially retain the benefits they've seen to individuals in their states.
Hey, Sharif, I have a question about the opioid epidemic. We know that the crisis has been called by a lot of people is the worst drug overdose epidemic in our history. And just in 2015, more than 33,000 people died in the U.S. from opioids. And it's now considered like it surpasses gun homicides in the U.S. So you just mentioned the high-risk pool budget of $15 billion to deal with substance abuse. Do you think the CBO or even just, you know, in general, that amount is enough to address this issue? Because this is a growing problem nationally. And I think the president mentioned that he was going to handle this. But I'm worried about whether or not that's a realistic kind of amount to allocate, but also even a realistic attempt to address the entire matter.
The crisis of opioid addiction in America is certainly a public health crisis at a national level. We've seen unprecedented numbers of people across the spectrum of income succumb to opioid addiction. And most people actually start becoming addicted through normal prescription opioids prescribed for conditions that cause pain, be it in an injury or a broken bone or a disease as serious as cancer, where you would want to prescribe opioids. The senators that have come out against this bill often have cited the opioid crisis as a reason that they're quite concerned. In particular, Senator Portman of Ohio mentioned that in his statement after the passage of the American Health Care Act by the House, saying that many people who benefited from Medicaid expansion have been brought into addiction recovery programs and because of their coverage have been able to get treatment for opioid addiction. So Medicaid expansion covers a broad swath of the population, or could cover a broad swath of the population that is afflicted by this condition. But again, it should be emphasized that this opioid crisis does cross income lines, it crosses socioeconomic lines, and it's something that threatens really the whole country.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, Sharif, you know, you talked about how this ties into Medicaid benefits. The way in which the federal government under Obamacare has been funding Medicaid is considered something like an entitlement. And now we're moving to a grant block model. And I just want to kind of explain to our listeners like what the difference there is. This relates directly to the Medicaid expansion and how federal funding is given.
Critics of attempts to move to Medicare block grants and other ways of dispersing money to states have said that those are essentially strategies to ultimately reduce funding for those programs. In terms of the mechanism for dispersing the money, in theory, if you had the same money being dispersed by the federal government, why should one side of the spectrum have a different opinion than the other? So right. That is what's cited in terms of people being skeptical about these plans. I will mention that there are some changes to that with the American Healthcare Act. So right now, essentially, states get a percentage of claim by claim, or you get a service, medical service, and then your insurance company, in this case, Medicaid, pays for that service each time. And so what the original American Healthcare Act was going to do is change that to a flat, quote unquote, per beneficiary payment. So you had a number of people on Medicaid, you would get a grant that was based on that. So you would get, if you had 1,000 lives or 10,000 lives or 20,000 lives, as just an example, you'd be covered more proportionally based on that. What this bill does that was just passed is change that slightly to a lump sum Medicaid payment. And this is something that came out of a group called the Republican Study Committee, a conservative group of members in the House right now. And so this allows states even more flexibility to control benefits offered by different Medicaid recipients within their state. So they could say that if you are a certain type of person over a certain age, or have a certain set of conditions or identifying factors, that you would be covered differently. And again, critics are saying this is a way for states to avoid covering patients who otherwise would have been covered with the original plan. So really, this comes down to ultimately costs. And if your goal and your values say that you should be covering as many people as possible, this is something that you would oppose. But of course, if you're concerned about costs, these are ways to be more flexible in administering the program and reduce costs over time.
From the news organization that revealed Edward Snowden's secrets to the world comes a new podcast, Intercepted. Join veteran reporter and Intercept co-founder Jeremy Scahill for his weekly take on the current political moment and for provocative conversations about the issues behind the news. Scahill and guests like Julian Assange, Naomi Klein, Barbara Lee, and Denis Kucinich discuss the most pressing issues of our time, those unfolding in public and the ones hidden in the shadows. And the show regularly features performances from artists like Kimya Dawson, Immortal Technique, Brother Ali, and Tom Morello. Intercepted believes in holding those in power accountable, and the mission couldn't be more urgent than right now. So subscribe now to Intercepted on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I think going back to one episode that we had on the defunding of Planned Parenthood, this kind of boils down to the same trend that we're seeing of putting the onus on states to decide where all this money is going to go. And then obviously there are states that are not able to meet the needs of their constituents and always, some of them have been abusive. So, you know, with this new thing, and I know the CBO still hasn't come out with their evaluation, but with this new paradigm, is there going to be more chances for state abuses of this? Or are we just looking at something that's kind of already been there for a while and is going to just perpetuate?
Well, one thing to understand is that state governments are very different from federal governments in the sense that they have to balance their budgets year to year. And so they don't really have a choice to deficit spend or spend more money than they take in with taxes. Otherwise, they'd have to be bailed out, filed for bankruptcy, et cetera. So essentially, they can be viewed as companies from a fiscal standpoint. Therefore, states and governors have a very practical approach to this. Which is why you've seen governors across the political spectrum have different opinions about this bill and Medicaid in particular, because the more money they get to cover their citizens, the better, because they're responsible for achieving a balanced budget. The real reason why you have this rare unity of hospitals, insurance plans, state governments, governors around concerns for this bill is because at the hospital level, if you are getting people who no longer have Medicaid because they're losing coverage, There are laws that require you to still treat patients when they come into the emergency room. You cannot deny somebody emergency treatment by law at a national level if they come in for emergency care. And so therefore, hospitals have to eat that cost if somebody does not have insurance. What states also do is fund hospitals to a certain degree who are seeing these patients. And so from a state government perspective, that affects the state budget. It affects the financial stability of individual hospitals. And so what people are concerned about is that hospitals might close down because they don't have the finances to continue because of this law that says you have to treat people regardless of their ability to pay. And so in terms of avoiding a public health crisis, it's obviously in the state's interest to do that, but they also have to be able to pay for it. And so that's why it's important not to underestimate the perspective of states in wanting to get as much funding as possible for these vulnerable populations.
No, I've seen like in my work in civic engagement that it's a matter of, and it varies state to state, the level at which people are involved in pushing their lawmakers and are educated about how to do that. And I think this kind of does pressure people into becoming more involved at local and state levels to push lawmakers for what they need. So I don't always see it as totally apocalyptic that federal funds are being necessarily skimmed, because I think, you know, it's much easier for a person to reach out to their local rep than it is for them to approach somebody at the congressional level over issues of personal need and things that are immediately in their purview. So I get some of the concerns, and I get that we might be exposed to more issues at a state level of abuse of this or dysfunctionality in some way. But I also think that it just puts more pressure on people to start pushing. It may be very rocky in the beginning, but eventually, I mean, with faith in the system, I guess I feel it would work out. But this is definitely something where all Republicans are not on the same page, including me. I'd find a lot of problems in this bill.
I mean,
as well.
I understand what you're saying theoretically, Sarah, but I don't know how much lobbying could stop hospitals from shutting down if they're not able to meet their costs. And that's, you know, when you talked about kind of like the values that are underlying these debates, Sharif, you know, the what are the value being, you know, saving costs. To me, the idea, and this actually is an issue that I see a lot, I come from a background in immigration law, with the conversation on immigration and immigrants, is that, you know, if they are legalized and are allowed to like be part of the system, quote, and pay into, let's say, insurance and taxes and all that, it'll lower costs, because oftentimes they have to get emergency care, which becomes a taxpayer burden. So here, you know, for those sickest that we are trying to remove from the markets, if they're going to get increased emergency services, somebody's going to either foot that bill or those services are not going to be available. And from a cost perspective, I feel like there is a big potential in it actually increasing costs on taxpayers, whether it's at a state or federal level.
The point you just made about, you know, these costs are going to exist because the people with these conditions who don't have the incomes to get insurance on the individual markets that don't have jobs with bigger employers who give them insurance, they're still going to exist regardless of whether this bill passes or not. And so their health conditions will still be there. Their problems will still be there. And they're going to have to find a way to pay for their care in some way. And so by establishing a solution called high-risk pools, which again have only covered less than 250,000 people, you're talking about many, many more people who would still have to find a way to cover for their care who are in this more vulnerable, low-income population. And so someone's going to have to foot that cost. Will it be the states? Will it be the federal government? Will it be hospitals? All of these costs transfer ultimately down to some payer one way or the other, or the patient does not receive care.
Right.
I somehow feel like it's always narrowed down to this business, quote unquote, business solutions for these kinds of issues. And I worry about some of the things that are being pushed with this administration in terms of them thinking that it's like running a business and, you know, that the insurance companies will work it out and the free market will. And I get that I believe that could happen. But at the same time, there has to be a safety net.
You've seen some states with high-risk pools that they've touted as successes. They've structured them in ways that work for their populations. Again, I mentioned Oregon is one that was cited that had a pretty successful one before the Affordable Care Act. At the state level, you can sometimes come to these solutions that end up covering a bulk of vulnerable individuals. But the extent to which you can guarantee that nationally, state by state, is very questionable. Yeah. And you'll see, I think, in the next Congressional Budget Office score of this new bill, that some vulnerabilities will likely be highlighted.
And, you know, my understanding of the circumstances under which these high-risk pools have been successful in certain states is that it's because those states then had levied taxes, an increased tax to help pay towards or you know, subsidize those high-risk pools. So is that correct?
In some cases, that may have been the case. But in the majority of situations, because, again, these plans were designed not to have necessarily have a lot of people enroll in them, I mentioned the higher premiums. I mentioned that pre-existing conditions weren't even covered for 6 to 12 months, lifetime limits. The enrollment into these pools is much less than the people who could have potentially qualified for them. And so that's how the costs ended up being controlled. So it's more on the front end that you had a limited number of people in each state enrolling in these high-risk pools that was more affordable to the state. But that left a lot of people with conditions that did not have coverage.
I have a question, Sharif. You've authored a lot of publications on healthcare quality, on operations management and patient safety, and you also co-developed a methodology that you know, doubled clinical efficiency at Johns Hopkins, and you cut patient wait times by half. And you kind of translated that as a consultant for the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Pittsburgh Veterans Hospitals into you know, improved care access for veterans. How does all of this work into care for veterans? And I don't know if that's a completely separate system, because the VA is like the second most funded agency in the whole of our country. But, you know, how does this affect the landscape for veterans care?
In the VA and the veterans healthcare system in particular, many different solutions have been implemented over the last year and a half to 2 years that have substantially improved access. And so different improvement projects, different approaches to models of care have been applied across the country, and you've seen, I think, substantial benefits in access. But it's hard to translate that into something in the private sector that could work and compensate for individuals who weren't covered by insurance. When we doubled clinic efficiency in the pancreas multidisciplinary clinic at Hopkins, these are people who were coming in who had insurance, either from Medicare or from private insurance, and we were able to see them more quickly and do so in a financially solvent way because we were getting paid for each patient. If you don't have insurance and you can't get into the system at all, then efforts to improve efficiency and reduce per patient costs and hospitals won't matter.
Yeah, that's a big concern, especially since this president touted veterans issues as one of his main platforms in the campaign.
Well, one thing that we'll expect to see to an extent is that people who, veterans in particular, who were covered by Medicaid, either through Medicaid expansion or through an insurance plan on one of the exchanges state by state that the Affordable Care Act offered, many of those veterans would lose their insurance. And so for those who are also enrolled in the Veterans Administration, they will have to get in line to get care at the VA. And so one thing that we're looking at is the effect on access to care when you have up to 1 million veterans who would now want to receive care in the VA if they've lost their private sector insurance. Most of our veterans do receive care both in the private sector and in the VA to some extent for different services, but that number of veterans would substantially increase that depend almost exclusively on VA care if they lose their insurance as a result of this legislation. So that's something that the VA has to account for going forward.
Wow.
Sharif, thank you so very much. I mean, clearly you are an expert on all these. I mean, it really has been a fantastic interview. Is there anything that we missed that you think we should talk about?
Well, it's my pleasure, and I really appreciate it coming on. One thing I'll say is that the legislation is far from passed into law. So One thing that's sometimes hard to interpret from all of the media is that this bill will still have to go to the Senate. And as I mentioned, because you have two senators per state, and many states have benefited in some ways from the Affordable Care Act, most notably from Medicaid expansion, you will very likely see the bill substantially change after it goes through the Senate, most notably because you have already at least four Republican senators saying the current version is not acceptable. And so the process for that would require whatever changes that the Senate made would go back to the House for either approval of that bill or an entirely new compromise bill that the House and Senate would have to come to together, and then each chamber would have to pass that independently. So that will leave plenty of time for a lot of things. It will leave plenty of time for more people to come out with their positions on this issue from different stakeholder groups. It will give more time for the Congressional Budget Office to score the newer version of this bill, which will almost certainly increase the number estimated of people who would lose their insurance. And so one thing I want to emphasize is that this is far from over in terms of legislation that is passed into law.
So are you trying to tell us that the Rose Garden celebration was premature? Is that what's going on here?
I won't go as far as to say that, because obviously, you know, they did pass a bill out of the House.
Right.
But I will say that in terms of its effect on people's lives, we're not there yet. It'll be an interesting turn of events.
Definitely an imperfect version, and like a lot of Republicans have said already that weren't too happy with it, that, you know, we're still in the it's a long haul, and we're in this for a while at the Senate level.
Well, thank you so much, Ray, for joining us and for helping explain. Are you like kind of online, or can people tweet at you? Or
yes, my internet presence is in my personal capacity, so that's totally fine. You can reach me on Twitter at Sharif Eldahl.
Thank you so much. And we will also tweet at you, and so folks can find you there.
Yeah, thanks, Sharif, so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is why my parents wanted me to be a doctor, and I failed them anyway. Women's bodies are all uniquely, beautifully different. And if you're anything like me, you spent years trying to get the perfect bra fit, but you can stop tugging at your bra straps and second-guessing your size. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that are fit better and are more comfortable. They offer sizes from AA to G, as well as their exclusive half cup sizes. All you have to do is answer a few simple questions online, and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. And right now, Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of their perfect 24/7 bras free for 30 days. All you do is pay $2.99 for shipping, and you're on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. You feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. And if Third Love isn't your favorite new bra, just return it or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/45th now to get your perfect Third Love bra and try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/45th to try your new bra for free. thirdlove.com/45th.
And the bill that was originally introduced and still exists and passed the House today will take 24 million people off the insurance rolls. It will impose an additional age tax on millions of seniors. It will, in fact, increase from 24% to 29% the premiums of those who have insurance either through their employer or on the private market. The majority of members of the House of Representatives knew this was a bad bill today. America should lament the fact that all of them didn't vote that way. And America will hold them accountable.
It's really easy to read in the media stuff and kind of get all hyped up about it. And I did feel like that gathering at the Rose Garden was a little premature and kind of like, what is that all about? So I like that he kind of explained where the Tuesday group or the Tuesday club and then the Freedom Caucus was on that whole thing. I think it balanced it out a little bit for me.
No, I definitely think he brought a lot. He's so knowledgeable.
It's a Tuesday
and,
group.
Really fantastic guest. Thank you so much for finding him for us, Sarah. You know, the garden thing, that press conference, that I thought it was a bit of a circus, but I think it goes to the heart of, like, turning all of these issues into battles, right? Instead of understanding, like, this to me, healthcare is not a bipartisan issue. Republicans get sick, Tea Partiers get sick, you know, progressives get sick. We all need healthcare. And one thing I want to emphasize, because this is so ironic to me, for people around the world who are listening to this, that we are not right now fighting to keep free healthcare. We are fighting to keep healthcare that we pay for. Like, we just want access to healthcare
through the nose. I mean,
It's so expensive. And that's the thing. So we're not even fighting for free healthcare. We're fighting for healthcare that we are still paying hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars for every month, on top of which we pay deductibles. And then, you know, this is the irony. It's like, you know, people don't understand America's the wealthiest nation in the world, but we... healthcare, for some reason, we really perform badly on that. But, you know, and I do understand that, you know, maybe, okay, you're right, that there has been a lot of, I mean, since this passed, it has been almost hysteria level coverage in the media. But I think the plus side of that, which also you alluded to in the conversation, is propelling people to action then, right? So this is the time to act. And I guess this is kind of like the closing thought that I want to leave listeners with. It hasn't passed in the Senate. You know, Sharif said that there's a long way to go. It's not that far away to go. It's the Senate. And so we now have, you know, we have the time right now to block the bill as it is, if we are concerned about any of its provisions. This is a time to be calling your senators, to be phone banking, and to really understand, like, why it is that nearly every health-related organization, right, stands against, opposed to this bill. And it's not always because of money issues, right? It's because of quality of care issues. It's because sick people are going to die issues.
Realize that politicians work for us and for them. The most important thing is the vote. And if, you know, things are ticking you off and you're in touch with them and you're letting them know what you want, they're going to listen.
Right now, House leadership is on break. They will be back in their home states. Give them a visit. Say hello.
Yeah,
and call your senator's offices. Please be engaged on this issue, because we do need a continued level of, not hysteria, but attention, to make sure that, we keep our most vulnerable, the people who are sick. And, you know, you don't have to be poor and be sick. You can be wealthy and be sick and still go bankrupt with medical, medical tragedy. So anyway, thank you so much to the listeners of 45th for tuning in this week. We hope that gave you a good deep dive into, the healthcare debate, and we're going to continue to stay on this. And next week, we hope to be back with the whole team. It's been a few weeks since we've done that. And we will do what we've done before, which is go through a number of different issues that we're all thinking about and take listener questions. Thanks for tuning in again this week. And we really hope to keep coming to you weekly. But in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod. And Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mito Talhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
Oh, I have to tell you guys, my kids are very picky about cute babies. And they came back from an event that I was at with Sharif, and they're like, oh my God, she's so cute.
Sharif's baby?
He's got the cutest little one. She's so adorable.
Thanks, guys.
Cute. I hope to meet her one day. Thank you so much, Sharif. You have a great weekend.
Thanks, Sharif.
I love that your kids are picky about babies. That means they find some babies ugly.
Well, they're like me. That's I'm like, if your kids are not cute, I'm not babysitting.
That's hilarious. That's me.